You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Dr. Robert Lustig, professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and a member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies at University of California, became a pediatrician in part to relive and help channel the wonder and delight involved in growth. But over his four decades in the field, he's noticed that both children and adults are experiencing addiction and depression at higher rates than ever before, and it may be linked to the very things we believe bring us pleasure. He joins us to discuss his observations and research in his book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. It is published by Avery, and I'm pleased it brings him back to the show, and it's our reunion, because you were here like 3 years ago, you said.
Absolutely. It's great to see you.
Great to see you, too.
I was on with the cookbook, and now we've just taken this and gone even further.
So I want to get back to something that I said in your introduction, and that you've noticed that both children and adults are experiencing addiction and depression at higher rates than ever before, and it might be linked to the things we believe bring us pleasure. What?
Well, if you take a look at the epidemiology of both addiction and depression, things really took a, shall we say, grand increase in terms of rates and prevalence in the early 1980s, and it's been going up ever since. For instance, prescriptions for antidepressants quintupled once Prozac came out in 1987, and then yet doubled again in the last 10 years. And if you look at addiction, well, all you have to do is just look at what's happened in terms of the opioid epidemic. The question is, what belies these phenomena that we're seeing? On top of that, then throw the diabetes epidemic, the stroke and heart disease epidemic, the hypertension epidemic, the fatty liver disease epidemic. And the fact of the matter is, our healthcare system can't help and pay for all of this. And that is why we had the election of 2016 that we had.
Wow. So we've gone way, way far afield here. So let's go back to the beginning of your book, and literally the beginning of your book. And that's the dedication to your mother,
yes,
which I did read. And it's very touching. And you say, basically, she is a depression era child who had to become an adult by the age of four.
Right. My grandparents owned real estate on the Upper West Side, some brownstones, and my mother was showing apartments when she was 4 years old. She never had a childhood.
And for her, because of that, did she put everything into making sure that you and your siblings had a childhood and that you were happy?
No, I can't really say that. my mother thought that money was the key to happiness, and I never thought so. In fact, we had many, many arguments over my childhood and my adulthood, mm-hmm, over that issue. She liked to buy stuff. Mm-hmm. She liked to go places.
Casinos. Exotic locations.
Indeed. And she had a lot of fun, but I can't say that it ever really brought her happiness.
And how did that manifest itself to you? Because it sounded like she had a great time.
Well, she had a great time, but she basically just never, ever felt a moment of contentment until she married her second husband. Mm-hmm. And then he unfortunately passed away way too early, and she was pretty bitter.
So childhood, you write, is a time of mind expansion, not just in knowledge, but in experimentation, inquisitiveness, in trying out new concepts and strategies. Now, how are electronics and those devices in the digital age impacting this critical mind expansion period for children?
Well, so we can talk about the philosophical side of it, and then we can talk about the neuroscientific, mm-hmm, side of it. So from a philosophical standpoint, basically what we've done is we've taken away imagination, because it's all provided right there on the screen all the time at the touch of a button.
Right, and right there in these narrow screens, all the focus is right there, literally inches, some a foot or so, or sometimes inches away from the kid's face.
Right. Well, the concept of pleasure is, you know, realized very easily with, you know, our screen culture. You know, hit a button, got Netflix, you know, Snapchat, or, you know, Facebook, or whatever else. So pleasure is easy to find now for kids. The problem is that it's the imagination that ultimately provides happiness and contentment. And the problem from a scientific standpoint is that pleasure is dopamine. Happiness or contentment is serotonin. And it turns out that dopamine is the one thing that makes your serotonin go down.
Well, see, now you're jumping ahead. But before you get there, because I was going to ask, you know, parents complain that their children are addicted to games or their phones or social media, but it's
and
not.
They are.
So it is an addiction.
It's not
the actual game that they're addicted to. It gets back to dopamine and serotonin you were talking about.
Well, so dopamine is the driver of reward. So there's an area of your brain called the reward center, and every single hedonic substance or behavior works through that same reward center. So it doesn't matter if it's nicotine, alcohol, cocaine, sugar, street drugs, or hedonic behaviors, shopping, internet, video games, Facebook, porn. You know, bottom line is they're all reward. And, you know, we love reward. In fact, we were designed to love reward because reward is what gets us up out of bed in the morning.
Right.
Without reward, you might as well just crawl in a hole and die. In fact, we did that experiment about 10 years ago with a drug that never got approved. It was an obesity drug called Rimonabant. It was the anti-marijuana drug. It was the anti-munchies drug. Caused a lot of weight loss. Also caused 21% of the patients who took it to suffer severe depression, and a lot of them committed suicide, which is why the FDA never approved it. It's now disappeared.
Wow.
So you take away reward, you take away the reason for living. So we thrive on reward. The problem is we've got a little too much of it.
Uh-huh. I was going to say, I mean, basically, we'll never be happy.
Well, we can, but you have to understand the difference between pleasure and happiness.
Wait, they're not one and the same?
Well, they'd like you to think they are. And if you go online to Google or to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, this is my favorite, and look up the word happiness, it actually has two definitions. One is hedonism, and the other is the life satisfaction theory. And I'm going, since when does hedonism equate with life satisfaction? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And this is Stanford. I don't know what's going on out there. I live in San Francisco. I don't know what's going down on the peninsula.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was going to say, that's not that far.
No, it's not.
Wait, so what is this life satisfaction theory?
Well, let's bring it back to this concept. These are two positive emotions, pleasure and happiness, and everyone's got them confused. So let's define the differences between them. Number one, pleasure is short-term. Happiness is long-term. Pleasure is visceral, that is, you feel it in your body, in your bones. Happiness is ethereal, you feel it above the neck. Pleasure is achieved alone. Happiness is usually achieved in social groups. Pleasure is taking, happiness is giving. Pleasure can be achieved with substances. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. The extremes of pleasure, all those things I've just mentioned, behaviors or substances, in their extreme, all lead to addiction, every single one of those. Yet there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And then finally, the pièce de résistance, pleasure is dopamine and happiness is serotonin. So two different biochemicals, two different areas of the brain, two different sets of receptors, two different regulatory pathways. It's like, why do we care? So what? Who cares? Here's why. Dopamine excites neurons. Now, neurons like to be excited. That's why they have receptors in the first place. But they like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. When you bludgeon a neuron with chronic overstimulation, that neuron dies. Excitatory neurotransmitter called excitotoxicity. It's one of the reasons why everybody got upset about monosodium glutamate way back when, because glutamate is a neurotoxin. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter, but it is also a toxin when provided in constant and chronic dosing. So here's what happens. You get a hit, you get a rush, receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush, and the receptors go down, and then you need a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit until finally you get this huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons start to die, that's called addiction. Serotonin is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It doesn't downregulate its own receptor because it's not bludgeoning the neuron. So you can't overdose on too much happiness. But there's one thing that downregulates your serotonin: dopamine. So the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. Then throw a little stress on top, which downregulates both the serotonin receptor and also the dopamine receptor. And now you've got full-fledged, full-out addiction and depression.
So then, wow. So then how do you get clean from this kind of dopamine addiction? You get that big hit of dopamine, which is easy in this day and age. How do you wean yourself off?
Well, and it's everywhere, and it's in your pocket. You have a slot machine in your pocket, right? And it goes off at funky times, telling you all sorts of stuff. Now, the thing is that when it goes off, you don't know what's coming. So sometimes the messages on your phone are good, and sometimes they're bad. Okay? Just like a slot machine. Sometimes it gives you some money, and sometimes it takes some.
Sometimes, most of the time, it takes some.
Well, indeed. So this is called variable reward, and this is built into your phone. In fact, the two-second delay between the opening of your Facebook account and the bing for how many new emails you have is engineered right into the product, very specifically to heighten the tension, to grab that reward, to up your dopamine. And then this variable reward basically keeps you coming back for more. So it's a vicious cycle. They've given you an itch that you didn't ask for. You have to scratch that itch. The reward is variable. Sometimes the itch gets scratched and sometimes it doesn't, which only then leads to investment of more cell phones. And in fact, we've got the iPhone 8 coming out tomorrow. Do you really need to spend $1,000 for another cell phone?
Well, no.
I mean, this cell phone is going to let you put virtual furniture in your apartment and let you kill the zombies sitting in them. Okay. Is that really what you want to spend $1,000 on?
I mean, there are some people who would say, well, yes.
Well, I guess so. But, you know, then the question is, what's going on in their brains?
You know what? That's a good area to stop, to take this break. You're always fascinating, Dr. Lustig. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig about his latest book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. Before the break, I was having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig about his new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. And we were having this discussion. You were like blowing my mind, talking about the differences between pleasure and happiness, and there's a very clear line between the two. But then during the break, you were talking about some other stuff. Talk about happy hour, happy meal,
sure.
Pharrell's happy. How do they factor into this conversation?
The point is that our society has been engineered, and I can explain how it's been engineered, to confuse and conflate those two terms, pleasure and happiness. They mean two different things, yet you didn't know the difference until I pointed it out to you. And you went, oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, but people don't necessarily know, and they're actually not supposed to know. And that's the reason why I had to write the book, was because people do need to understand this, or they will be subservient to, shall we say, corporate America for the rest of their lives. This is engineered. It's called the American economy. I'll give you an example. The most famous of all. Coca-Cola's Open Happiness. Now, is there any happiness in that bottle? There's sugar, which causes type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and fatty liver disease. There's caffeine, which is definitely a reward stimulus. So I won't argue that it's got two rewards, okay? But in terms of the metabolic syndrome, in terms of the medical costs and expenses that it delivers to the individual who drinks it and to society for having to pay for it when they show up in the emergency room, no happiness there. Let's try happy hour. Okay. We've got, alcohol, okay, is a great reward stimulus, but, it's not so good for happiness. And we see that, in all of the alcoholics and in all the breast cancer that alcohol drives. How about the happy meal? Okay, now the good news
now
about
now you're in trouble.
All right, well, the good news about the happy meal is that fewer kids are buying happy meals. The bad news is they're buying from the dollar menu instead. Okay, but is there anything happy in that happy meal? Maybe the toy? Not really.
The fries?
The fries with the acrylamide and the never mind. We won't go there.
You're just like killing my buzz here. Right. Keep going.
Well, I hesitate to mention his name, but Pharrell Williams' song Happy is very happy listen to it, right?
It's a fabulous song.
Fabulous song. Yeah, except for the video. Okay, so there's a video online. Go look it up. Happy 12 a.m. Okay, 2 minutes into the video. Pharrell is, it's midnight on a South Central L.A. convenience store. Okay, and he is buying a Red Bull, two candy bars, and a bag of potato chips. Okay, at midnight. Now, do you think he's going to get any sleep? You think he's going to be happy? Really? And why was he fingering the Red Bull? I mean, that was product placement at its worst. Okay.
Wait. Come on. Who's to say that Pharrell at 12 in the morning with a Red Bull and candy and chips and all that, why is it not possible that he could be happy?
Do you think that that's a good message to be delivering to today's youth?
Well, I mean, when you put it like that, no.
Well, that's what we got.
But to your point about Red Bull and the candy and the chips, like, he's not going to get any sleep.
All right.
Which gets back to dopamine and serotonin.
How about Kellogg's Raisin Bran? Okay. The road to your happy place is filled with raisins and flakes and pavement. Really? Is that right? Do you know how many grams of sugar there are in Raisin Bran?
No.
18 per serving. Now, turns out when you do the raisins, there's 10, which means there's 8 grams of added sugar coating the raisins. And if you do Raisin Bran Crunch, it's 29 grams of sugar. You think there's any happiness in that bowl?
So
really?
So you really think that corporate America is in on this scheme to conflate pleasure and happiness and make people think they're happy when corporate America knows for a fact that what they're selling us is not happiness at all?
In fact, they know it. They know it. The question is there a conspiracy? And the answer is, I don't have any data to support a conspiracy. That is collusion amongst industry actors to specifically inflict malevolence upon the public and defraud the public. That I do not have. Okay, but a plot? Absolutely. Very specifically, because we see the machinations of each individual corporation as they use this strategy.
So we've spent a whole lot of time talking about the reward issue here. But you write in the book, there are three pathways. There's the reward pathway, which we've been talking about. There's also the contentment pathway and the stress-free memory pathway.
Fear memory pathway.
Fear.
I wish it was
I
wish it was the stress-free memory.
I kept reading that stress.
That would be good.
Stress-free. Gosh. It's my glasses. It's my glasses. So these are just three of the hundreds of areas in the brain.
Yeah.
But what is it about the other two? Let's start with stress, fear, memory, since I got that one wrong because I cannot see.
Sure. Absolutely. So there are four brain areas involved in the stress, fear, memory pathway. One is called the amygdala. And the amygdala is a walnut-sized area of the brain. There are two of them on either side, and they are the fear center. So when you walk down a dark street, you know, in lower Manhattan at 3 a.m, you know, with, you know, that's your amygdala, you know, sounding off, if you will. Okay. The hippocampus is where memories are laid down. So like when you touched your mother's hot stove and pulled your hand back, okay, that was laid down in your hippocampus. Hey, don't do that again. Okay. And then there's another area called the prefrontal cortex that sits right above your eyes, and that's your Jiminy Cricket, if you will. That's the part of your brain that keeps you from doing stupid things. Okay. And then finally, the hypothalamus, which is where all of this stuff is integrated into releasing a hormone that ultimately tells the adrenal glands on top of your kidneys to release the hormone cortisol. Now, cortisol is your stress hormone. You need it in order to keep your blood glucose and your blood pressure up. But too much cortisol causes death over time. And that is what why stress kills.
So if you get too much cortisol, how do you how does that manifest itself?
As hypertension and as depression. It will also manifest as visceral fat, big belly fat, which we know is correlated with insulin resistance and all of those diseases of metabolic syndrome that we mentioned before. So cortisol is a bad actor. So you want to keep your cortisol down. Mm-hmm. But if your stress fear memory pathway is going great guns, your cortisol's, you know, sky high. But, and cortisol is super high all the time in depression.
But so then, I mean, we live in stressful times.
Right.
People have multiple jobs. They've got all sorts of things. Credit card debt, student debt, family issues.
All the above.
How do you, what do you do, Doc?
So what you got to do is you got to tamp down the dopamine and up the serotonin and get the cortisol down. So in the book, there are 4 keys to happiness, 4 ways to mitigate these negative phenomena. That is the excessive pleasure that leads to addiction and also the excessive stress that leads to depression. Okay, those 2. 4.
Okay.
Number 1, connect. Now, connect does not mean Facebook. Connect means eye-to-eye interpersonal connection. It's got to be eye-to-eye. And the reason is because you're reading the facial expressions of the person you're talking to, and there is a set of neurons in your brain called mirror neurons, which actually transduce that signal that other people are giving you, turning it into a phenomenon we call empathy, and that is a direct driver of serotonin.
What about people who don't have empathy?
What about them? We have one in the White House.
Moving right along. Number 2.
And he, by the way, he's missing a prefrontal cortex while we're talking about it.
Okay.
Okay. Number 2, contribute. And that doesn't mean to your IRA or to your bank account. This means contributing outside of yourself. Now, can you contribute through work? The answer is absolutely yes, provided there are 2 things, 2 provisos met. Number 1, you can see the value in your work to others. And number 2, your boss can see it too. If you can get those 2 things out of your job, then work counts as contribution. However, if not, and a lot of people don't see that, then they have to find their contribution somewhere else, whether it be through volunteerism, altruism, philanthropy, many different ways, but it has to be outside of yourself and it's not for credit. So getting Boy Scout badges doesn't count. Number 3, cope. Okay, and there are 3 things in cope. Sleep. Okay, because sleep deprivation is one of those things that drives cortisol and depletes serotonin receptors. Number mindfulness. So everyone prizes multitasking. Guess what? Only 2.5% of the population can actually do it. The rest of us, it's smoke and mirrors. And all it does is make your cortisol go up and make you miserable. And number 3, exercise. So it turns out exercise is probably the best upper of serotonin and the best downer of cortisol there is. And it can actually fix depression all by itself. Mindfulness and exercise are as potent as Prozac in being able to mediate depression.
And is that because, I mean, is that the just being active or is it the chemicals that it releases?
It's the chemicals that it releases. And then finally, number 4, the pièce de résistance, cook.
What?
For yourself. Yes.
Okay, you just
and
lost
for your
me.
Family. No. Well, there are 3 items in food that matter. One is tryptophan because it's the precursor of serotonin. It is the rarest amino acid. It's hard to find. And your body uses it for many other things, so it never gets into your brain to even get turned into serotonin. So you got to eat enough of it. Eggs, fish, poultry, okay? Vegan people don't get enough. And they think they're eating a great diet. Not so much. Number two.
Wait a minute. Isn't tryptophan, is that the same as what we get in turkey?
Yeah,
that's the stories we get every Thanksgiving
yeah.
time.
Yeah, that's
okay,
a good place for it.
Yeah.
Number two, omega-3 fatty acids. So that's in marine mammals, but wild-caught marine mammals, because they eat the algae, we eat the fish, okay? Because the algae make the omega-3s. Okay, farm fish eat corn. They make omega-6s. You need the omega-3s because those actually prevent brain inflammation and allow for better serotonin neurotransmission. And then finally, number three, the one you want the least of, fructose, sugar, because that's something that depletes serotonin. Ups your dopamine, depletes your serotonin, ultimately makes you miserable, but it takes a while. So you can have an ice cream once a week, not once a meal.
Right. Okay, fine. I mean, that's where I am. Once a week, once every so often.
Yeah, make it special. Make it worthwhile. I'm even going to go out and on a limb. And I actually had a sorbetto last night, okay? Right on Columbus Circle.
Uh-huh.
It was a lemon ginger sorbetto, and it was really good. And I enjoyed it, okay? And it's the first sorbetto I've had in about, 3 months.
But really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it, and it tasted great.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig about his new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. And so that was just the stress, fear, memory pathway.
Right.
And those four things were really good to know. Now, what about the contentment pathway? Because we haven't talked about that.
Well, so the contentment pathway starts deep in the brain, in an area called the dorsal raphe, makes serotonin, and fans out to the entire rest of the brain, to that prefrontal cortex, in order to keep your executive function working, and also to the entire rest of the cortex. Now, serotonin is the contentment neurotransmitter when it interacts at one brain site called the 1A receptor. But it's also the receptor for hallucinations. It's where LSD works, is on the serotonin 2A receptor. And what's really interesting now is that they're finding all these new uses for LSD and for other serotonin agonists because of their effects on the 1A and 2A receptors. Like, for instance, they're giving ecstasy to autistic people, bringing them out of their shell. They're giving LSD to people with terminal cancer because it's actually helps them deal with the ultimate departing this world, and, you know, reduces the fear. So they're finding things in these new clinically controlled studies that say that serotonin is super important and we should be upping our serotonin virtually any way we can.
Well, that's interesting that ecstasy and LSD, two drugs that we've heard, you know, people abuse, all sorts of horrible things happen to them. But what you're saying is if these highly addictive drugs are used in a very controlled manner, that they have beneficial properties.
So number one, no one's ever shown that those drugs are addictive. They've shown that they can be dangerous, but they've never shown addiction.
The addiction is
on the dopamine side,
okay,
not on the serotonin side. Now, can you get a bad batch of LSD and get a bad trip? Absolutely. If you don't have a tour guide for your magical mystery tour, you can end up in a pretty bad place. In addition, these are being dosed by licensed psychiatrist right here at NYU. Steve Ross is conducting one of these terminal cancer studies, and the data, I've seen them, are really remarkable. But it's a one-time dose, and and the effects last for 12 months. It's really kind of amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but in the limited time that we have left, we should talk about the term hack, which you use in your title. What exactly do you mean by hack in The Hacking of the American Mind?
So hack is a term that we have appropriated. You know, I mean, other than a butchery, we didn't use the word hack until 1955, when my alma mater, the MIT Railroad Club, used it to describe a clever response to a complex problem. And Silicon Valley engineers, you know, sort of stole that word, you know, to talk about what they did in terms of solving complex computer problems. We now call that white hat hacking. But there's this other thing called black hat hacking. And that's, for instance, you know, taking over computers, all the viruses you've heard about, the phishing, et cetera, the stealing of the DNC emails, et cetera. That's all black hat hacking. So why do I say that this is hacking? Because after all, our brain doesn't run on computer code, but it does run on information. And there are two kinds of information out there in the world today. There's marketing, in which you use information to espouse your point of view. And then there's something else called propaganda, which is using disinformation to espouse your point of view. What's the difference between the two? What's the difference between marketing and propaganda? The truth. Something that has been buried very recently by companies, by politicians, by virtually everybody. We now live in a post-truth society. And this is, I think, the biggest hack of all. And it is the reason for this book, The Hacking of the American Mind.
In the epilogue, you pose an interesting question. How many people are addicted to either a behavior or a substance, and they think it's just part of their general personality? They might say, oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth, or I'm a chocoholic from way back, or that they frequently engage in retail therapy.
Right. They think that's just them. In fact, they've been engineered to have those phenomena happen to them. Everyone is just a product of their biochemistry, and biochemistry drives behavior. And unfortunately, messages coming from the outside can change your biochemistry. That's the point of this book.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, about his latest book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. Great to see you again. Thanks very much for coming
on.
This was fascinating and fun.